Hello and welcome to the Nightfall Project. My name is Bianca Finkler and I'm coming to you from the Netherlands. Our program is dedicated to provide you with new information and interviews with like-minded people and teachers from different lines of alternative knowledge to enhance self-education and support the awakening of human consciousness. For more information, videos and downloads, go to our website on nightfall-project.com. I will talk to Andrew Johnson, who is the creator of the website checktheevidence.co.uk, which is a huge source for research and reference material on fields like 9/11, anti-gravity research, life on Mars and chemtrails. Andrew has a degree in computer science and physics. He worked in software engineering and software development, but he also has been tutoring and lecturing at a College of Adult Education and is now working for the Open University. We will talk about topics like free energy, the truth behind 9/11 and chemtrails. Andrew made himself some very deep-going research on this field, and it is an honor that he took the time to share his knowledge with us. If you want to know more about Andrew's works or download his free ebook called 9/11 Finding the Truth, visit his website checktheevidence.co.uk.
Hi there.
Hey, hello, Andrew.
How are you doing?
Oh, fine. Hey, it's so nice to have you for a talk today, and thanks for taking the time to do this.
Not a problem.
Andrew, you have a degree in computer science and physics. You worked in software engineering and software development, but you also have been tutoring and lecturing at the College of Adult Education, and you are now working for the Open University. You are the founder of the website checktheevidence.co.uk, which is a huge source of alternative research into fields like 9/11, anti-gravity research, life on Mars and chemtrails. I'm very impressed how much information you've been collecting on your site. Andrew, would you tell us some more about it and about your researchers?
Sure. As I've described elsewhere, you know, the website really started because I'd begun to collect quite a lot of information, and I felt the need to share it with anybody that would, you know, sort of follow some of the same, you know, paving stones in the path that I'd follow. Mm-hmm. And that really started for me in round about 2003, when I came across the Disclosure Project, which was the UFO disclosure initiative set up by Stephen Greer.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I've said to other people, I at that point knew that there was a cover-up. I had no doubt at all, because of the level and the scale of that event that Stephen Greer put together, and it had received no media coverage in this country. You know, I live in the UK, and all I could find, you know, I came to it about 2 years after it happened, more than 2 years, I think. And I'd not heard anything about this in the press or on the TV or anything. And all I found was one single article on the BBC News website, and the headline was UFO spotters slam UFO cover-up, or something very similar mm-hmm. to that. And these UFO spotters, you know, were people who'd like looked after nuclear missiles and this sort of thing, you know, and you listen to the stories of Captain Robert Salas and, you know, Professor Robert Jacobs, and I'm thinking, well, this proves that the media are not reporting this in the way they would report any other story. You know, they're completely playing it down and ignoring it. And I think the other big thing for me in finding the Disclosure Project that Stephen Greer talked about at that time, he doesn't quite talk about it so much now as he did then, or maybe not in quite the same way, but it's the link between the so-called free energy technology and the UFO issue. And I think when he sort of said this in this press conference, and he basically said, you know, the UFO issue isn't secret because of the alien thing. It's secret because of the energy question. And then I thought, oh, yeah, you know, I think you're right. And curiously, when I first got an internet connection, in the sort of mid-90s, I think it was about 1996 when I first started going online regularly. And one of the first things I started looking for was what happened to cold fusion and all the free energy sort of stuff. You know, and those were the topics that I was initially using the internet for, not all the time, you know, but I spent a fair proportion of the time trying to find out what happened to cold fusion and that sort of thing, because I was always very interested in these alternative energy sources and what was going on, you know. And so that was really a big, you know, connection for me from what Stephen Greer said. And I thought, yeah, well, I think he's really onto something here, something big. And that's what started off my renewed interest. You know, I've always looked at this, and I just sort of went on from there, really. And the website, I think I set that up, I think it was maybe late 2005, and then I had to move it to another server. So it's about 2006, I think, when I sort of got it underway, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's the history behind the website, really.
Yeah, well. Well, and you've been interested in the UFO phenomena as well since you've been a child. But the first research you made on this was the Wendlesham incident in 1980 at the Bentwater military base in the UK. Can you tell us what this incident was about?
Oh, yeah. Now, that's a very, very interesting case. And I remember hearing about that. In 1980, we've got a newspaper in this country called, I think it was the Sun. It's a Daily Mirror and the Sunday People. I think it's changed its title now. I don't think it's called the Sunday People anymore. I think it might be called the Sunday Mirror or something. But anyway, I get the names of those papers mixed up and I remember seeing the headline. It said, UFO lands outside military base and that's official. And that was from the MOD. And that was the headline on the paper, you know, and that's obviously a pretty amazing sort of headline. Excuse me. And I remember reading about that a little bit at the time, but not really having the means to follow it up then. And when I was at school, I did A-level studies, which are the sort of 16 to 18 age range when you do those. And I did, one of the subjects was just called general studies that we did. And we had to do a project on a subject that we chose. So I choose to do my project on the UFO issue. And I don't think there was much information about the Wendlesham incident at that time. And it wasn't until 1983 when a chap called Larry Warren, who was a security policeman at Bentwaters Base on the two nights when these events happened, He asked for a memo that had been written by the Deputy Base Commander, Colonel Charles Holt. He asked for that to be released under a Freedom of Information Act request. And he did get it released, much to his surprise. I forget the exact circumstances. And Larry Warren, since that time, since 1983, has been a big campaigner over the Bentwaters incident. And he basically has always said from the offset that there were two landing sites. In other words, that takes us into actually what the story was. It was around about Christmas time. I think it was 26th of December. I might have got the dates slightly wrong. 26th of December, I think 1980. And there was a chap said, oh, there's a UFO has landed outside the base. And this was at Bentwaters Base, which is in Suffolk. It was one of two twin bases, Bentwaters and Woodbridge, which are sort of back onto each other, or I think they're a couple of miles apart or something. And UFO lands outside the gate, and the chap goes to make his report, and then it's sort of glossed over and forgotten about. And then I think it was two or three days later, somebody walks into Colonel Holt's office, Colonel Holt being the deputy base commander, and he said, it's back. And Colonel Holt says, what's back? And he says, the UFO. And Colonel Holt says, oh, this is just some guys larking around making some nonsense, you know, for Christmas time. And so he went out, and he went out with a couple of guys, and he went out went off base into the woods, and, you know, he had his dictaphone with him, a little pocket recorder, and he recorded his reactions to what he was seeing as he was walking along. He had about 20 minutes of tape, and you can download this recording from the internet, because that also got released later on. And he describes this extraordinary sequence of events, objects flying over him, beams coming down to the ground in front of him, and he says on the tape, "This is unreal." And then the object flew over the base, and he was with, I think, three or four guys in the woods, and then there was another chap called Sergeant Jim Penniston, who was off away, I think some distance away, actually further away in the woods, and I forget the exact, because this incident went on over, I think, two or three nights, and I forget which things happened on which nights, but basically Jim Penniston was another sort of, he was a sergeant, and his job was to go and, he thought when they first saw this thing, it was a crashed aircraft. So he went over to it, and he started to write notes as if it was, you know, he treated it like an aircraft. He had his notebook, and he was writing his notes. And then whilst he was in the zone of doing his job, you know, he's just trying to be very professional, just write everything down, make good notes so he could report back to the base over his radio. And then he began to realise that this wasn't an aircraft. It was actually a triangular craft, and it had these symbols on the side. And he touched it, and he felt the sort of slight amount of heat coming off it.
He actually touched it.
He actually touched it. Yeah. Oh. And he kept on writing his notes as best he could. But then I'm not actually sure how he went away from there. I think he had to go away and make his report. And I think by the time he came back, it had gone or something. Or he went back to relay some of the information to some of the other guys because the radios weren't working. He tried to set up a relay with the radios or something like that. I can't remember all those details, but his story has been told many times. You know, you'll find the stories on YouTube, on various documentaries. But the point about that story is, it's a story involving multiple witnesses, military-trained people. It does involve nuclear weapons being stored on the base as well. And Larry Warren had some very peculiar experiences, I think, on the second night, where he was with Gordon Williams, I believe, and they'd gone out into the woods to see this craft. And Larry Warren actually describes how he saw these entities coming out of the craft and floating off the ground. And he said that there was somebody there with a movie camera, you know, a film camera, and they were actually filming this. He doesn't know who this was, and he's never seen the film, but this is what he tells in his book, The Left at Eastgate, which was actually banned in the UK. They would not allow that book to be sold in the UK for quite a few years. I think it has now gone on sale, I think, in after the year 2000 sometime, but it was a long time before that book came onto sale in the UK. Yeah. But Larry Warren openly admits that some very strange things happened to him after the event. What happened was he was taken into a room, you know, after all these events had transpired a couple of days later, and the threats were made against him. You know, he said, you know, if you talk to anyone about this, you know, bullets are cheap, you know, so that's what we're going to say to you. And he was told all these stories about these things have been here for thousands of years, and you know, we know about them. But he also talked about being injected with sodium pentothal, which is a drug which affects you. You know, it's meant to make you tell the truth. It's called a truth serum, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, his head was messed with. You know, with threats, with sodium pentothal, with maybe some type of hypnosis of some kind, or sleep deprivation, something mm-hmm. like that. So Larry Warren basically considers the whole thing a human rights issue. That's the way that he looks at it, because of the way he was treated as somebody who was serving for his country in a military base. He was basically treated like a terrorist, you know, because of what they actually witnessed. And of course, you know, he's never come to terms with his treatment. I've met Larry a couple of times, actually, and he's an absolutely genuine guy. And he's very much got a passion for wanting to get to the truth of what actually happened on those nights, of which very little has really, you know, relatively little has come out. But we've got multiple witnesses. You know, Charles Holt, the base commander, has told the same story for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Larry Warren has, Jim Penniston, there's John Burroughs, and there's another chap, Edward Cabanzag. All their stories corroborate at some level. There was another chap off in the radar tower, Gary Barker is his name, or Gary, I can't remember his name, but he also talks about tracking these objects on radar, on the same nights. So there's multiple corroborative evidence. The story was investigated by Lord Admiral Hill Norton, who at one time, he was the Admiral of the Fleet in the UK. In other words, he was one of the chiefs of the defence staff, you know, of the whole military, the Navy, in fact. So he was a very, very senior guy. He investigated the stories. He said to his superiors, you must take this story seriously because, you know, British airspace has been invaded. And whether it's, you know, a UFO doing it or whether the guys just made it up and they made the whole thing up, it's of defence significance, you know, because we don't want these people who are running the base to be making stories up. But he knew they hadn't made it up. You know, he'd seen that they'd got plaster casts of the ground. Some photographs were also released. He'd heard Colonel Holt's tape that he made. So he knew these people were telling the truth. So that is a very significant incident, the Rendlesham incident. There are several books being written about it. I think probably Larry Warren's and Peter Robbins's, which is called Left at Eastgate, is probably the most comprehensive. But also this year is the 30th anniversary of that incident, and they're trying.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're trying to organise a get together, apparently, of all the guys, and maybe have, I don't know, a press conference or something. They've got something in the works, apparently, but I don't know what the details are. But you might hear about that possibly from somebody before the end of the year.
Or maybe from your website also?
Yeah, well, I'll post stuff on there. Yeah, I've got a news list, and I just post stuff onto that. So, yeah, it'll go onto there if anyone tells me about it.
You actually pretty early realized that there's something going on, that facts and evidences are being hidden away from us and hidden away from history. And is it right if I say that you did spend a lot of time of researching and exposing the stories?
Well, I tried to. In fact, when I became aware, you know, I mentioned of the Disclosure Project, I thought this was really, really important. And I knew that the media weren't covering it. So essentially, at that point, and this was in 2003, I took it upon myself to, you know, I downloaded the video and I made it into something I could play on a laptop computer, you know. And I got one of these, you know, these LCD projectors. And this is, you know, 7 years ago, and they were quite a bit more expensive then, so I spent quite a bit of money on that. I basically wrote to various local groups, you know, who had might have an interest in this sort of topic. Mm-hmm. I wrote to a few women's groups that, you know, that meet locally and have coffee mornings, and sometimes they'll get a speaker in showing slides about, you know, a project they've worked on or something like that. And I wrote to them. There were a couple of sort of retired businessmen's groups, call them Probus groups here, and I wrote to a few of those. I did three or four of those meetings, and I basically took the laptop along and I showed them a bit of this press conference, like 20 minutes or half an hour, and then I would describe what I thought it was, you know, what it all meant in terms of the cover-up and why it was important that people should be thinking about this. You know, and generally got a positive reaction. You always got one or two who thought it was just a load of rubbish. But, you know, a few people were a bit gobsmacked, really, as I was, that this hadn't been, they hadn't heard about anything about it. So I did that probably, I probably did about 10 or 15 of those over a period of maybe 2 or 3 years, something like that. And then following that, I'd started to investigate other areas because one example that you mentioned in the introduction was the anti-gravity technology. And I started to put together some information about that because that was kind of a logical offshoot of the UFO technology. When you look at, you know, how do these things fly, and various people have reported it, some type of levitation effect, or these things can accelerate at enormous speed very quickly.
And of course, I guess, connected to the free energy issue, I guess.
Absolutely. Because once you look into those things a bit more, as I started to do, and you tend to come across things like, you know, Project Winterhaven, which would involve Thomas Townsend Brown. Townsend Brown was a sort of experimental physicist, and he was working between the 1930s and the 1970s. on things related to what's called the Biefeld-Brown effect, which was basically an apparent anti-gravity effect, which is generated by high voltage. This is what I ended up putting into this presentation. And then you've got other people like Wilbert Smith, who I came across, who's a very, very interesting person. Wilbert Smith is not talked about very much. He was became superintendent of radio regulations in Canada in the Canadian government, very senior position, and he did a lot of research in the 50s, came to the conclusion that, you know, these craft were real, they were coming from other planets. He'd established contact with some of the occupants through intermediaries. They gave him instructions how to build technology, which he built, simple things like a binding meter and a special type of radio coil. And he also built an anti-gravity experiment where he was able to reduce the weight of an object by about 1%, obviously a very small effect, but he proved that it was real, and he knew it was a real effect. So he was very keen to get people to, you know, develop from what he'd done and take it on. But then he realized that it was a lost cause because I think he probably realized that there was another group already knew what he was trying to explain to everybody, and it had already been turned into a secret project, into a black project. And this is what Nick Cook also concludes in his book. Nick Cook has written a book called The Hunt for Zero Point, which I think was published in 2004. He concluded that anti-gravity research went underground in about 1956, and this Project Winterhaven that I mentioned seemed to be a part and parcel of that somehow. Because Nick Cook argues that all the aerospace companies, you know, were involved in anti-gravity research, serious anti-gravity research, up until the mid-50s, and then almost overnight they all stopped doing it and said, oh, you know, there's nothing in it, we're not going to get anything out of this. And it's as if it, all overnight it all went underground. And so I think that's almost certainly what happened. If you look at the National Security Act in 1947, not long after the Roswell incident is meant to have happened, and I think it did happen, then they had carte blanche to declare any matter in the US to be of national security. In this country, we've always had the Official Secrets Act. So, you know, I don't know if we've always had it, but we've had it for as long as I can remember. The government in this country can just say, oh, this is, you know, a matter of national security, and then no one's allowed to talk about it. So with those sorts of covers, and obviously, as you know, the ridicule attached to the UFO phenomenon, then they can basically keep this pretty well covered up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, what kind of Hollywood movies, you say ridiculous, yeah. Absolutely. That's how they do it.
Absolutely. But I also then began to discover a kind of, and I'm trying to put a sort of timetable on this, because as I researched more and more into this, you know, and I was very interested in these different areas. I wanted to find what the connections were. So whereas you'll find a lot of people, you know, I don't claim to be an expert on anything particularly, except what I did for a living, which was computer programming. I mean, there are certain aspects on that which I think I probably call myself an expert, you know, and I've got paid for doing that, obviously, for that reason, because I've done a lot of work on it and I've learnt a lot. But this sort of thing, it's an interest, a passion, a mission, call it what you will, but I don't, you know, I haven't got a professional qualification in it. I mean, who has, for goodness sake? You know, you can't get one. But I've tried to go off into these different areas, such as the anti-gravity research, looking at the anomalies on Mars, looking at 9/11, and looking at the UFO issue, looking at things like consciousness, which going back to Wilbert Smith, was something that he came to conclude at the end was very, very important in understanding the UFO phenomenon, was this idea of consciousness and thinking how we as spiritual beings, you know, interact with the universe and this sort of thing. And I'm interested in that as well. But other people like, for example, I talk about Stephen Greer. He didn't seem to be interested in any of these things. Like, he didn't talk about any of the anomalies that were found on Mars. And then you look at somebody like Richard Hoagland, and he doesn't talk about UFOs. He says we don't talk about those things. And that at first I thought, well, that's probably just because it's just their interest, you know. Different people are interested in different things, and maybe I'm just different because I'm just interested in lots of different things, and I try and find, you know, what I think are the key points of evidence. And that's what I tried to do, so that I can summarize them for people, basically. But then, particularly when I was doing 9/11 research, because I probably spent much of my time over a period of about three years, really. I kind of did the Disclosure Project stuff, and I got to a sort of, not exactly an end point, but there didn't seem to be anything particularly new, you know, from there. So I then started looking into 9/11. And I got involved with a 9/11 research group called Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Mm-hmm. And I got invited to join that group, much to my surprise, to be honest with you, because although I am associated with the Open University, I don't have any research post with that organization. Mm-hmm. I'm not a researcher for them. I'm simply a tutor who helps students with computer courses, and that's basically it. And it's distance, mm-hmm. it's distance learning as well. So it's, much of it is done by email. I do give tutorials, you know, little lectures, but that's only like four or five times a year, something like that. So I do have to prepare a little set of notes for that, and I do like a PowerPoint and this sort of thing, you know. And then we'll go through questions that are in the course and things like this. So you know, it is a teaching job, but it's a minimal job in that mm-hmm. respect. And you know, and you're paid in accordance with that. It's a part-time job, in other words. And I do some assessment work, which is done on a freelance basis, also for the Open University. But I don't have a research post. I don't have a research grant. I have never had any papers published. And this is what surprised me when I got invited to join this scholars group. And eventually I found out what that scholars group was really for. I was glad that I got involved with it, because it then ended up with me finding out how all this stuff is interconnected, mm-hmm. you know, as I've concluded. Because in the scholars group, for example, I was invited to join by Stephen E. Jones. And he's a physicist from Brigham Young University. And I thought, oh, fantastic, we've finally got an academic person to come out and say the official story of 9/11 is, you know, not true. And he's written this paper about thermite, you know, and I trusted that he was telling the truth. And I was so pleased that somebody in the academic community was actually finally prepared to stick their neck out and tell what I thought was the truth. Well, the official story of 9/11 is not true, you know. And over a period of probably about a year, I began to realize, thanks to getting in contact with somebody called Dr. Judy Wood, who was a mm-hmm. professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University, I began to realize that what this Steve Jones character was saying was actually another cover story. In other words, it was a second cover-up. And I then found out, much to my surprise initially, that this Stephen E. Jones professor, who I thought, as I say, was a, you know, an honest person, and he seemed to have a sense of humor and everything, and all this kind of thing, he was actually involved in the cold fusion story. And because what happened with this chap was, I don't know how much you remember about the cold fusion scenario, but what basically happened was, in 1989, there were two chemists held a press conference at University of Utah, and they came and had a big press conference, and they said, look, we've got this experiment, and we can put it in a test tube, we can put these chemicals in, we put them into a palladium electrode, and we charge it with heavy water with deuterium, mm-hmm. and we put some electricity into it, we mix things in a certain way, and we get this fusion effect at room temperature. And they were getting more energy out than they were putting in. In other words, they put, say, you know, just to give an example, not the right figures, mm-hmm. but they put 100 watts of power in and get 150 watts of power out. And, of course, they were saying that what was happening was nuclear fusion. And all the scientific community said, oh, no, that's absolute nonsense. You can't do that. You can't have fusion in a test tube. You have to have a huge, great, big reactor, you know, that costs $1 billion and has a heat high, you know, sort of hot plasma in it contained in a magnetic field. And it's the only way to do it is these tokamak reactors and blah, blah, blah. So no one believed them. But they did have experimental results, which they've been working on for 5 years. But the day before Pons and Fleischmann held this press conference, this Stephen E. Jones character had published his own research about a slightly different process called muon-catalyzed cold fusion. And it was later revealed that he'd done this because he knew he got a tip-off that Pons and Fleischmann were going to have this press conference about their research. So he was trying to, you know, sort of steal their thunder, as it were. And then later, this was written up in a book by Dr. Eugene Maloff, who was murdered in 2004. And he wrote this all this story up in a book called Fire from Ice, which is out of print, and it was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. And this Stephen E. Jones character, he's mentioned on 100 pages of this Dr. Mallow's book. So when I found out about this, I'm thinking, oh, this is very interesting. Because as I said earlier on in the, you know, in our discussion, was one of my early interests was cold fusion. And then so here I am 10 years later in 2006, finding out about 9/11, finding out about Stephen Jones, and finding out he's connected to cold fusion. And I'm thinking, what's going on here?
Somehow the circle was closing for you, huh?
Absolutely it was. Mm-hmm. And so I then began to become very suspicious of what Stephen E. Jones was up to. And as it turned out, my friend Dr. Judy Wood, she'd started to put together the evidence, and she'd been working on this really, I mean, to be honest with you, since the day it happened. Dr. Judy was never fooled by what happened on 9/11. She knew the moment she saw it that what she was being told wasn't true. Now, I didn't. I was fooled by the official story for probably about over three years. And it was only in about 2004 when I really began to re-examine it. And I think like a lot of people, when 9/11 happened, I was deeply traumatized by it. You know, and I couldn't even, I remember just feeling cold, physically cold, as if, you know, it was a winter outside for 2 days. I was shivering and I was not shaking out of fear, but just shaking out of a kind of coldness that this, something like this could have happened in our time, you know. And so that, like for a lot of people, arrested my analysis of such things.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what a trauma does with people, you know. They can actually forget in the next day what happened the day before, just because of their trauma, you know.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, I wasn't a victim either. I was just an observer. So for those that were victims in one way or another, you know, I mean, imagine what it's like for them. And you know, so it wasn't really until 2004 I started looking at it. 2006, I came into contact with Dr. Judy. And she'd basically, say, started to gather a lot of evidence. She'd looked at a lot of pictures. And she'd concluded that the World Trade Center must have been destroyed with directed energy weapons. And this was very, very interesting. The point being that when you actually look at some very simple observations that she pointed out, and I really hadn't thought about it deeply enough, was that the towers didn't collapse and they didn't fall down, they actually turned to dust. And what hit the ground wasn't building, it was dust. And again, if you go and watch the videos, anyone can go and watch this, any of the people listening, you know, can go and watch, just go and watch the videos a few times. They rarely show them on television, and you'll literally see the towers turn to dust before your very eyes. You know, Dr. Judy was pointing out some very simple things. Although she's, you know, got advanced degrees in materials engineering, science, and this sort of thing, she was just pointing out the basic observational facts. And what then happened was like, wow, you know, she was attacked left, right, and center. The scholars group started attacking her because she said, you know, the buildings were dustified and this isn't an English word, and bloody, bloody, blah. And then Steve Jones says, oh, she thinks it was space beams that destroyed the World Trade Center. And at that point, you know, really, I began to sort of realize what was going on, that Steve Jones was actually part of the cover-up. And what they were covering up was one of the same reasons as the UFO cover-up. They were covering up the advanced technology. And it's the advanced technology which was used, you know, in one mode of operation to destroy the towers. And so by 2007, I was very, very comfortable that Dr. Judy Wood was absolutely right in what she'd concluded, because if you looked at the evidence on her website, you know, and you can do this now, anyone can go on to drjudywood.com and look at all the pictures there. Basically, all she's got a selection of the pictures that she's discovered. She's got a few captions, and she's basically saying, why is this picture like this? Why is this picture like that? Have a look at it. See what you think. You know, you've got cars that are upside down. You've got cars which are burnt on one side, not on the other. You've got huge burnt cars on the outside, huge burning on the outside. Mm. And then you've got the upholstery on the inside, not burned on some of these pictures. Some other peculiar pictures that she came across. In the buildings near the World Trade Center, they have double glazed, you know, glass units in them, you know, two panes of glass. And if you look at some of these pictures that she's got very carefully, and you don't notice it unless you look carefully, you will see that in some of these panes, some of these sections of glass units, only one pane is broken. So how can you have only one pane of glass broken and the other one not? If it's a projectile coming through the glass, it would break both panes. It doesn't just stop in the middle when the panes are only a centimetre apart or something. So, you know, you have to look at these details, which is what she was doing. And she's got hundreds of these things. And then she discovered the weird fires where we've got these huge car fires going on next to paper that's not burning. Car's burning, paper isn't. You know, what burns first, paper or a car? Well, paper burns first, and then a car would burn because paper is easily combustible. Again, some people say the towers were destroyed with explosives. Well, you look at the amount of explosives that were used to destroy somewhere like Dresden in the Second World War. You know, there's nothing left of that city. Well, the towers disappeared in 10 seconds, and yet what happened in the streets of New York? Paper was blowing down the streets. Paper was blowing down the streets. So if there was a huge lot of explosions, or thermite, as this Steve Jones claimed, that thermite is an incendiary, burns about 2,000 degrees centigrade, if that would have been used to destroy the towers, how come the paper survived? Paper would have burnt up.
Yeah.
So there's some very basic, obvious things that Judy was pointing out to us all, me including. I was listening, and it seemed to me like virtually nobody else was. But as she moved on through the story, she actually decided she was going to sue somebody because what had happened was, and this was also another suspicious thing with the Steve Jones character, was the NIST group, government agency basically. NIST stands for the National Institute of Standards in Technology, and it's basically like a U.S. government body which oversees various standards. One of the things you'll see, if you've got a Windows computer, you can get it to synchronize the time for your clock, you know, your PC clock, with NIST.gov. In other words, they have an atomic clock in somewhere, you know, in some system somewhere in America, and you can get your computer to read the time from that clock over the internet. And so that's, you know, NIST are involved in standards, that sort of thing. One standard, of course, is the time. And so they were mandated by Congress to look at the destruction of the World Trade Center, explain how it happened, you know, and why it happened. And they were given, I think, $15-16 million as a you know, budget to produce these reports. And they ended up producing 10,000 pages of reports. And you can download them all. They're all freely available on their website. You can download them for free. I downloaded them all into PDF files. But what they did was, to come up with those reports, they used various contractors. They didn't write the reports as part of their own, you know, within their own agency. They decided what needed to be analysed, and then they broke up that work, I think, into about 22 or 23 contracts. And they dished that work out. You know, this company's got to look at the supposed plane crash and what damage that did. This company's got to look at the fire proofing. This company's got to look at how the building collapsed and blah, 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 blah. And they did all of that. And you can go, and that's all on the website as well. You can read all the details of that. And they eventually, in 2005, in August 2005, I think it was, released the documents, the final documents, after whatever, four years of work, maybe three and a half. And this was supposedly explaining the destruction of the towers. But as Dr. Judy looked at these documents, they didn't explain anything. I mean, what they actually did was they reproduced, in one section of the report, a whole floor of the World Trade Center, and they, you know, rigged it all up with fire to make it set on fire, you know, put combustible materials underneath it, and they burned the fire in this simulated floor of the World Trade Center, constructed from, you know, pretty much the same materials. They burned the fire for twice as long, twice as hot, and it didn't collapse. There was no collapse at all. There's nothing. Yeah. And yet they signed off that report as being a valid, fire has been a valid explanation for the destruction of the building. And that was Underwriters Laboratories that did that. So they were clearly signing off on a report. It was fraudulent. They called the report the collapse of the World Trade Center towers. You can go and see that on the cover. But as Dr. Judy points out, the towers didn't collapse. They turned to dust, and it is a big distinction to make. And she actually wrote to NIST, and she told them before she sued them that they had an opportunity to correct the reports under the Data Quality Act, which is a U.S. law. They refused to correct the reports. They claimed that they, in the letter to Dr. Judy that they sent back, that they didn't investigate the collapse. They only investigated the events up to the point of collapse. So she has got that in a letter from NIST that they didn't investigate the collapse, even though the report is called the collapse of the World Trade Center towers. So that was basically fraud on its face, as far as, you know, as far as I could tell. So she then went ahead and sued the contractors for fraud. And I must mention at this point that three of the contractors that she sued were very interesting, because they were called Science Applications International Corporation, which I'd also heard of in relation to the Disclosure Project, because that Stephen Greer had mentioned them in his papers and documents. Another company was mentioned, which was called Applied Research Associates, and they all have their own websites. And the other company was, of course, Boeing, who everyone's heard of, the aircraft manufacturer. Mm-hmm. But those three companies were very interesting because they all do research or manufacture into directed energy weapons. So that was a very interesting link that Dr. Judy had made with the energy issue. She also wrote to Kirtland Air Force Base. They have the Directed Energy Directorate, which is based at Kirtland Air Force Base. You know, they've got their own website. And she wrote to them and said, "Can you tell me any more about any directed energy weapons which might have destroyed the World Trade Center?" And she sent them, you know, the pictures, selection of the pictures that she compiled. And they actually wrote back to her, amazingly enough, and said, you're describing effects that we can't explain, you know, but we don't have the research ability to follow this up for you, or help you. But the peculiar thing is that the Air Force Directed Energy Directorate didn't say, "What do you mean you're saying this was caused by directed energy weapons? We all know Al-Qaeda is responsible." And you'd think to get a letter back from the U.S. Air Force, it would say that, but it didn't. Mm. And you know, again, this letter's on Dr. Judy's website. So that was very, very strange. But what she was firmly established, and to me it was irrefutable, was that there was an energy effects were involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And some months after this, when she looked at some more pictures, she started to notice the similarity between various effects and what is known as the Hutchison effect, which is essentially an energy effect. And I'd already come across John Hutchison again. This was one of these things where I'd come back in something of a circle, because I'd come across John Hutchison myself in 1999. And again, this chap that I mentioned, Nick Cook, he writes about John Hutchison in his book, The Hunt for Zero Point. And Nick Cook went to see John Hutchison, I think, in 1999 or 98. And John Hutchison had basically done some very interesting experiments where he seemed to have been able to levitate things to make things fly up, you know, off the floor of his apartment, using only 1,500 watts of power. He was able to levitate a 70-pound cannonball. And, you know, he'd actually been able to reproduce this, not 100% reliably initially, but he'd actually was able to reproduce this, and various companies filmed it. Now, if you go and search for John Hutchison on the internet, you will undoubtedly come across a page which says, oh, you know, all these videos are fakes, John Hutchison's a fraud, and everyone kind of attacks him. But actually, he was visited in 1983 by Colonel John Alexander, who worked at the same place Stephen E. Jones worked, which was Los Alamos National Laboratories, which is where they developed the A-bomb. It's one of the big sort of defense, you know, research places, as I'm sure you're aware.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so I was actually sent some documents by somebody in Scotland, because they'd previously been looking at John Hutchison's work, and they'd written to the U.S. Defense Department with the Freedom of Information Act. So we've got the documents which prove that they did indeed send a team of people to visit John Hutchison in 1983. I've even got an audio clip of Colonel John Alexander, who was at one time head of the non-lethal weapons program in the U.S. military. He admits he went to see John. They worked with John for 4 months. My understanding from John is that they seemed to know what they were looking for when they came to see him. And he was able to generate these levitation effects. He was able to make metal turn to jelly. He was able to, he saw times when he had these weird fires. And basically, to cut a long story short, Dr. Judy had discovered all of these effects in the World Trade Center evidence. We'd got cars upside down, which looked like the result of them flipping over during levitation. We'd got metal bent into a horseshoe shape in the steel girders that were stored by WJE. We've got weird fires where metal was burning and paper wasn't. We've got evidence of high heat, yet no heat. Obviously, the paper is unburned, but the metal on the car is all twisted as if it has been melted under high heat. So, you know, she came across all of these effects, and then it was January 2008, it was December 2007, I think she made the first internet posting, connecting the Hutchison effect to 9/11 in terms of the effects that were seen there in the aftermath and during the events. We also had witnesses being levitated. I've got two video accounts, not actual videos of them being levitated, but video accounts of the people saying they were levitated on as the towers were being destroyed. We've got another few witness accounts from the New York Times record, from the oral histories, talking a couple of those people were levitated. One reports diving under an ambulance, and then the tower came down, and he puts his hands over his head as the thing's coming down. He gets up, and the ambulance is gone. So how can that have happened? How can this ambulance have disappeared from over his head, yet this guy's still okay? You know, what's going on with this? You don't get that with just a wind effect or a building coming down. And nobody will talk about this. Stephen Greer won't talk about it. Most of the 9/11 truth community won't really talk about it. And yet, the evidence is clear for all to see. It's all in the evidential record if you go and look for it. So, what I was then coming to the conclusion about was that John Hutchison's work was very important. But because, if you go and look at his website and you go and listen to him, he's not what you'd call... you know, he's not been to a university, he doesn't have an advanced degree, he's not been given a PhD or anything like that. He's basically someone who's just got a natural intuition for doing what he does. He's worked out how to develop his own research, he's worked out what works and what doesn't. Over a period of 20 years, you know, it's not, some people said to me, oh, well, he can't have just stumbled across this effect. Well, he didn't just stumble across it, really. He was doing various experiments, and then he gradually refined what he was doing over a period of many years. And he was also working on free energy technology. He was working on these crystal batteries, which will produce energy from a sort of certain set of crystals if you put them together in a certain way. And they don't run out. They only give a very small current, but nevertheless they appear to be everlasting batteries, you know, as it were. And then John says that he knows people that have been in touch with him because he had a contract with the Pentagon at one time, although he didn't really follow it up. People got in touch with him through his contacts there, and he says that the military have these battery replacers. They call them battery replacers. You know, so they replace batteries in these things. So what do they do, we wonder? So what really I think we saw on 9/11 was some of the advanced technology that they've got being used, and they've really been working very, very hard to actually keep up. That's what was used. And I began to realize that because I described earlier on about the thermite story was basically a cover story. It was a second cover-up. And still it's the 9/11. You know, I met somebody this weekend. I was talking to somebody this weekend. And I talked about what I've just told you, and they said, "Oh, but I thought it was thermite." And I said, "No, it wasn't thermite." And it's the only alternative 9/11 story that people have heard of. They haven't heard about the Hutchinson effect, and they haven't heard about Dr. Judy Wood's court case, because no one will talk about it. And the other thing that nobody will talk about is the hurricane. Were you aware that there was a hurricane near New York on 9/11? I don't know if you'd come across that.
Oh, no, I didn't.
yeah. And that's another thing that Dr. Judy discovered. Because what she was doing is, in an effort to find out more about the way the towers have been destroyed, she was looking at the sort of plume of material. We're not going to call it. She deliberately didn't call it smoke because she didn't think that smoke would imply fire. So she basically did was she looked at the plume of material coming up, and she saw that she needed to look at satellite pictures. So she did, and then she saw on the satellite pictures this hurricane. And it was Hurricane Erin. And then she went to look at the Hurricane Erin because obviously that caught her interest. And she noticed that Hurricane Erin started on the 1st of September in the Atlantic, and it moved across towards Bermuda, and it was a sort of tropical storm by then. And it hit Bermuda as a tropical storm, did a bit of damage, which was reported by CNN. And then they said, "Oh, nothing to worry about, it's going out to sea, no need to worry anyone." But if you go and look at the path, and again, you can go and look at the National Hurricane Centre or NOAA, you know, or they've even got records in the UK Met Office, which I found a map on there. And it went in pretty much a straight line. It went from Bermuda, more or less in a straight line, in a northwesterly direction. And at 8 o'clock in the morning on 9/11, it was at its closest point to New York. And then the next day, on the 12th, it made a right-hand turn and went off out towards Newfoundland. And the barometric pressure, the wind speed, and the temperature, as measured at JFK Airport, were all constant for 24 hours throughout the events of 9/11. So how peculiar is that? And what Dr. Judy thinks, and I agree, is that what we're talking about here, because what this goes back to John Hutchinson again, we didn't really sort of explain what he does, but he's been messing around with electromagnetic fields, electrostatic fields, microwave radiation, mixing them together and seeing what happens. When you mix these different energies together with different frequencies, this is when these effects seem to come out, like the levitation, the weird fires, the bending of materials, the changes in materials at an atomic or a molecular level. And it's all to do with what's called field effects, mixing together different fields. And one of the things that John Hutchinson has used was what's called a Tesla coil, which has, you connect it to an electrical supply, and it has a long column of coiled wire, and at the top it kind of like has a dome, which gets charged with electricity, high-frequency electricity. Mm-hmm. And if you look at a hurricane or any storm system in profile, you know, side on rather than from above or below, you will see that it looks the similar shape to a Tesla coil. And we all know, of course, that storm systems are electrically charged because of thunderstorms. So we think that Hurricane Erin was put there deliberately because of its field effects, and that played some part in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And I don't know exactly what, but and I don't think Dr. Wood knows exactly what either. But we once she started making the connection to the Hutchinson effect, that's when the attacks started, the personal attacks, and these became quite vicious, actually, to be honest with you. And sometime after this, when I realised that we were being attacked, because, you know, there's an old saying that the flak is strongest when you're over the target. Yeah. And the scholars group, as was, initially what happened was, just to go back to that for a moment, I joined the group with Steve Jones and another chap called Jim Fetzer. Then that group split over, really, arguments about the directed energy research of Dr. Judy Wood. That was one of the key areas that it split. And Jim Fetzer split off onto one side and Steve Jones on the other. And I kind of stayed with the Fetzer side, and he seemed to be quite supportive of the directed energy weapons research that Dr. Wood was involved with. And then as soon as she made the connection to the Hutchinson effect, Jim Fetzer basically declared that John Hutchinson was a fraud and it was stupid to pursue this line of research. So he basically completely reversed his support for the research from that point, which I thought was very peculiar, bearing in mind we had things like the documents, that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, from Los Alamos, proving that they'd investigated John for 4 months. You know, they hadn't just gone to see him for a weekend. They worked with him for 4 months, and he'd had contracts with the Pentagon. So we knew that John was doing, you know, serious research, however goofball it may have looked to some people. We knew that this had actually had public money spent on it, you know, at some time or another. And Fetzer simply refused to acknowledge this, or refused to acknowledge that it was important. So at that point, I realized this was another, I call it perception management in the book that I've written. I realized that there was this operation to keep this information hemmed in, penned in. It got out, it was in the public domain, but basically it's just a numbers game. I mean, and we found it very, very difficult to get this information exposed to anybody, even among the groups that you would think would be going, wow, you know, this is, we've got to cover this. I've talked to other UFO researchers, not interested. I've had to write articles about them, won't talk about it. They'll talk about 9/11, they'll talk about thermite. Will they talk about the hurricane? No. Will they talk about John Hutchinson? No. So what we've basically got in this situation then, you've got all these other websites talking about 9/11, you can go and look at thermite everywhere, and that's got everywhere now. And then we've had another one talking about nuclear explosives being used, that got re-enlivened earlier this year. And then we've got my website, Dr. Judy's website, and literally I could probably say about four others, which four or five others which mention these connections. So as long as the internet is swamped with the other stuff, the thermite, this, we don't get a look in. So it's a numbers game, you see. That's how it seems to be working. And we can't really fight that, because it's taken us this long. I mean, it's taken me seven years of research to reach this point of making all these connections and feeling that, yes, we can say hand on heart that this is true. It's not speculation. We've got the evidence to prove that what we're saying is true, and this evidence was taken to a court of law. It didn't get very far, as you might expect, because the court system is as controlled as everything else, really, to be honest with you, when it comes to matters like this. And some people just can't believe it anyway, because it's so big. You know, they just can't believe that you would have this level of cover-up. The fact that there are two 9/11 cover-ups, the official story, and then people like Steve Jones and Jim Fetzer, people just find that very, very hard to deal with. But this is the conclusion that I've been forced into making, not only because of what Dr. Wood's come up with, but because of my own interaction with these people. You know, I've documented all the emails that I've exchanged with these people, and I felt I didn't really want to do it, to be honest with you, but I felt that I've had to do it because it's basically become a historical record. what's actually happened. You know, and I've thankfully we've had one or two people that I know. You know, I know I've been through a lot of details and everything very quickly. Fortunately, I've had one or two people that have actually been able to go to my website and read some of the articles and understand what I've told you and why what I'm telling them is true, because we've got all the evidence there. So I think it's, you know, I feel that in myself, I'm happy that I've done that documentation process to the best of my ability in the time that I've had available. You know,
and you did.
Yeah, you know, and really the one issue is the numbers game, which I've mentioned. You know, all the other websites won't even talk about this, and I do think they are controlled. I really do. It sounds quite paranoid, I know.
No.
But it's unbelievable. Honestly, it is. It's unbelievable. And you know, so we've got the numbers game. We've got the incredulity of people in general, because as you and I both know, most people just want to have a quiet life, watch TV, drink beer, and you know, that's about it for a vast majority of the Western population anyway. So to sort of even mention about UFOs and aliens, I can't talk about that, you know. So so we've got all of that, but we've then got an active program to actually make sure that it doesn't get out, because frankly, when people know that the free energy technology is real, we don't need any fossil fuels, we don't need oil, nothing like that. You know, all the stuff that Tesla did, some people have heard of that. But the problem is for the free energy community is the other reason why they can't get their stuff to be developed by any big companies is because the military industrial complex already know about it. They've already developed it themselves, and they used it as a weapon, and they destroyed the World Trade Center with it. So that's why, or one of the main reasons, which nobody talks about because they don't know the evidence that I've just described to you, that's one of the other reasons why we haven't got the free energy technology in large-scale uses, if you want my answer, because it's already been weaponized, and it's been used, and they probably used it on the Oklahoma Alfred P. Murrah building in 1995. It looks like they used something similar for that as well. So in terms of the 9/11 stuff and the UFO stuff, that's where I've seen the connection as laying, really, in the free energy technology and the black projects, the black programs, which have absorbed all these trillions of dollars, and they've turned it into a weapon.
Okay, yeah, and you also made some very deep-going researches on chemtrails, and in 2007 you published a 20-page report of your own analysis on chemtrails, which you posted on the internet, and you sent it to Greenpeace, World Wildlife Fund, the Department of Transport, the Department of Environment, the Royal Air Force, and you wrote a press release, which you did send out to the media. Please tell us more about this report and the reactions you got on it.
Fine. That's right. Now, again, that kind of started, I think, probably 2004, 2005, when I got interested in that topic. And and the thing that really triggered me was the grid. I saw this grid outside my window, and it was like a, you know, you play noughts and crosses, tic-tac-toe, I'm not sure what you'd care to call it. And that's what it looked like in the sky, and I thought, wow. And this is right outside my window, so I took a couple of pictures, you know, and posted them onto the Coast to Coast website. They decided to post them, and got quite a few hits from that. That really kicked me off into looking at the whole chemtrailing issue and trying to work out what was going on. You know, I looked at Clifford Carnicom's website. He's done a bit of analysis into material that he says has come down into the water and into samples of material that he's been given, fibers, which are said to have come down from the chemtrails. And I'm not so sure about some of this. I'm not sure where, if these fibers come from this.
Me neither, actually. Yeah. I must say, me neither. I never was really sure about that. But when I've been in America, I saw a lot of that fiber stuff on people's houses, glass, and on the windows, you know, on their clothes, which they hanged out to dry.
Really?
But I don't know what is the source of these fibers.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I've heard various reports, but I've not, I mean, I had some spider webs in my garden, and I wasn't sure about those. But I believe they were actually very light gossamer spider webs, but it was peculiar because it was in October and it seemed a bit sort of late in the year. But I've since been told that there are some spiders, and they do have a particular, you know, week or period of few days where they're very, very active, and that's why you only get them, you know, at certain times and under certain conditions. So yeah, the fibres I'm not so sure about. Really what happened was I started off with a collection of pictures. The thing that most intrigued me about the chemtrails was these grids which were forming, and I couldn't really see, you know, I mean, if you go and look at the air traffic routes, because you can get maps of where the aircraft is supposed to fly. In fact, I eventually wrote to the Civil Aviation Authority, and they sent me a map, of the air routes. And, you know, just on the face of that, you can't really see how you could get these grids forming like this. So that was a bit of a mystery. And nobody has yet successfully answered my question of how these grids can be being formed just by regular air traffic. You know, the fact that you can get a plane going you know, northeast, southwest, followed by a plane going sort of from, you know, the sort of 90 degrees to that, you know, northwest, southeast. How is that going to happen, you know, in a short period of time? You know, these things have got to fly over within about 15 minutes of each other. And this was a big puzzle to me, and it still is, frankly. I still really haven't got any straight answers. So I put some of these questions into the report. I put some pictures in saying why are these grids being formed. I looked at some of Carnicom's pages. I pointed out that the US Air Force had denied any knowledge of chemtrailing of any kind. They debunked it, said it was all contrails. I put in information, for example, that my understanding was that normal trailing would only last for about 1 or 2 minutes. In other words, you should see a trail coming out of the back of a plane, and then it should be pretty much disappeared within a couple of minutes. But this was, this wasn't what you were seeing. You would see bits of trails, grids, bits of grids. But one of the other big puzzles to me was, you know, you could get two clear sunny days next to each other, and one sunny day there'd be a huge, huge number of trails almost blanketing the entire sky. The next day there'd be nothing. There'd be no trails at all. So if it's all just civilian air traffic, or even military air traffic for that matter, how can you get such a difference in the number of trails on 2 days, you know? And you only seem to get these heavy days of trailing about, I don't know, once every 6, 7 weeks, 8, 9 weeks, something like this. And so I really initially wrote to the Civil Aviation Authority to ask that question. Why are we getting these grids? Why are we getting these different trails? And they basically just said, oh, well, you know, it's just because we are. You know, we just, you know, that's what happens. Some days we get trails, some we don't, and that's that. That's just how it is. And they didn't really explain it. They weren't able to say, well, if you look at that particular day, the upper atmosphere was, you know, saturated with this sort of material from a solar flare or, you know, nothing like that. There was no explanation given by one reference from the Department of Transport. I was referred to a report called Formation of Contrails in the Atmosphere and Properties of them. And it was by Professor Ulrich Schumann of the Institute of Atmospheric...
Yes, from Germany, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Institute of Atmospheric Physics. So I read through this, and it's 26 pages long, and I kind of did a fairly heavy critique of it. And there were some useful figures in it. For example, I got out this figure that it said one of the ideas was that contrails would form in regions of ice supersaturation. In other words, where there was a greater amount of ice, you know, or ice crystals suspended in the air than you would normally have in that sort of those sort of conditions, because particular conditions would allow that block of air to become supersaturated with ice. And that was, you know, just a theoretical thing they hadn't really proved. And they said, the maximum size of these regions, as measured with LIDAR, which is like radar but using laser light, they said the maximum size was 150 kilometers. So, oh, that's interesting. Well, at least I've got a figure. This is one of the only figures in the whole report, frankly. So I went and looked at some of the satellite pictures, because you can see these trails on some of the satellite pictures. And I've got some information about that on the website as well. So, that gives me a figure to work with. So I looked at the satellite pictures and I looked at the scale, and counted the pixels and measured them in my little paint package thing. And lo and behold, I get a contrail that appears to be 300 kilometers long. So, that can't be the explanation. It can't be ice saturation because the maximum region is 150 kilometers. So I sent some of these questions off to this Ulrich Schumann and hoping to get some kind of response as to where I was going wrong, but I never got a response. So Greenpeace had never responded to what I sent them, and you would think that an organisation would take seriously this aircraft pollution, and it doesn't seem to be an issue for anybody. And that's the other thing. I mean, as we've heard, a lot of people saying, they're poisoning us all with barium and aluminium, and we're all going to die from these mycoplasmas and these bacteria warfare that they're putting in them. I mean, if we take somebody like Rosalind Peterson, she appears to have determined some evidence that there have been raised levels of barium and aluminium in the water supply in her county, in Mendocino County. This was going back probably about 4 years now, probably longer. And so she became concerned about that. But the problem for me, and I think probably for her as well, is linking that to the actual chemtrails. And I've been having an argument with somebody about this. If you're going to prove this, you have to link specific events to specific events of chemtrailing. So if you've got a water sample that's got raised aluminium in it, you have to then link that to specific, evidence of chemtrailing. And I could be wrong on this, I haven't seen all the studies and everything, but to my knowledge, nobody has yet done that to a repeatable degree. In other words, what could be happening is there could be industrial pollutants which are floating around the atmosphere and have not really been properly analysed. And it's those that are causing the barium and aluminium pollution and not the trailing from aircraft. I don't know. One of the problems with saying that there is stuff in the chemtrails coming out, if it's coming out of the engines, which of course it may not be, but if it is, then it has to go through the engine system. And if you've got metal in some form in the fuel, then it will interfere with the performance of the engine, and you'll get deposits building up and all this kind of thing. However, if you have got aircraft which have just got nozzles on them, and there's some separate system of delivering the spray, then obviously that's not going to be an issue. We don't have answers to those questions. And really the report that I did was just a collation of questions and asking for somebody to answer them or investigate them. But basically the response that I got was either nothing, and a total complete ignorance of it, or I'd get a response back saying, yeah, it's just contrails, there's nothing to investigate. And so that was that, and which was pretty much what I thought I would get, but I needed to check for myself just in case there were some enlightened people who would be prepared to look at it. But one thing that I think we can say with certainty is that even if we just take the what we call chemtrailing, let's just say there isn't actually any chemtrailing going on, it's just ordinary air traffic that's causing it. Even if you just take it at that at face value, we do know that on certain days it is changing the weather. There is no doubt about that, because there are certain days where you'll get loads of trails appearing. The cloud gets fogged in with haze, and that's it, your sun's gone. And that's purely as a result of the air traffic. But nobody will even talk about that. Nobody will talk about the air traffic changing the local weather conditions even. So that even at that face value, that's always puzzled me greatly.
This is also somehow connected to these traumatized people, because they just do like it's not visible. They are not looking up, and
absolutely,
it's absolutely unbelievable that they just can't see it. And the chemtrails are different in their persistence as well. If we look at the time that they are visible. As a child, I used to observe the sky, and I was watching the airplanes, and I remember that their contrails have always been disappearing after a few minutes.
Yeah.
But with chemtrails, it seems as if they don't disappear, and they are rather spreading out and forming all kind of strange grids, as you already said. And this makes it so unbelievable to me that people just can't see them. You know?
Absolutely, and I totally agree. And I call it chemtrail blindness, you know, because that's what it appears to be. It's like a specific condition. It's like an illness almost, but people can't see it. And I,
well, my child sees it. You know, my son is looking out of the window, and then he says, "Today is a chemtrail day or not?" Because there's a big difference between those beautiful clouds as we know it from our childhood and those, weird fading out, trails.
That's right. And I'm looking at the sky today, and I'm just before sundown here. We had all these parallel lines of cloud. Now, it wasn't chemtrails, I know it wasn't chemtrails, but we had all these parallel lines of cloud, and it looked like they were in bands, specifically. I'm thinking, this is not real cloud. This is being put here somehow. And, like I said, we've talked about the hurricane on 9/11, and I do believe that hurricane was put there. I don't know whether it was created and put there, but I know that it was steered there. We know that somebody, I don't know who it is, I don't know exactly how it's done, but somebody changed the weather. And that kind of brings me on, Simon, with what you're saying in relation to people not seeing it. Part of the reason seems to be, people are very busy, they've got their own interests, you know, they're not really looking up at the sky, as you say. But another interesting thing happened last week or the week before, because I did another, podcast much like this one, and somebody then listened to it. They contacted me and said, "Oh, Andrew, you were talking about when chemtrails, first appeared." And they said, "I think they first appeared in 1970 because I saw one in a film called The Railway Children." Mm-hmm. And I said, I'd have to check this out because I've seen that film and I've watched it several times. I don't remember seeing any trails in there. And so what this person actually sent me was a link to a YouTube video, and the YouTube video wasn't of the 1970 film. What it was of a commercial, an advert made for Virgin Trains, UK train company, in 2005, but it used some footage from the 1970 film. And so I went again, looked on YouTube, and the original film, the whole thing called The Railway Children, has been posted on YouTube. And I found the shot that was used in the commercial, and it had a chemtrail in it. And in the original 1970s film, there was a clear blue sky. So I got the two shots side by side, just to check for myself, and I've written all this up into an article. I've posted it on the website. So we know that in 2005, the company that made that commercial, and another chap that I know called Phil Morris, he actually looked who made the commercial. We found out who made it, and he wrote to them. Mm-hmm. He wrote to the company that made the commercial, and they admitted they deliberately put the trail in the commercial, in the sky. So
They're doing that even with children movies and, comics and in all the children movies you can see that. It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. So this is, you've got to ask yourself, why are they making the aircraft trail? Why not put a cloud in the sky? If they wanted to make the sky more interesting for that advert, why not put a cloud in it? Why did they have to put an aircraft trail in it? And they did it in Over the Hedge, the kids' movie Over the Hedge, which is completely computer generated. Yeah. That might be one of the ones you're thinking of, because I've got, I pinched that from somebody else's website. I think it was rents.com. Mm-hmm. I've collected a few of these that people have sent me now. I've found one or two myself, I think one or two literally. And then other people have sent me lists of these where they put these chemtrails in the picture. I discovered one on a book. I was going to a bookshop with my daughter a couple of years ago near Christmas, and there was a 1950s story called Goodnight, Mr. Tom, and I think it's set in wartime. And on the cover of this book, a children's book, they've got a chemtrail grid on the cover.
Yeah.
And I picked this up off the shelf and I thought, oh no, this is terrible. Because they're putting it into making it look normal. They're putting it in the subliminal messaging. So
excellent.
Yeah, so what there must be something, they must be doing something. You don't do that just because there's more air traffic in the sky. There is something going on. I think it's primarily to do with weather control and weather modification. I think that's the primary reason, but I can't prove that. And it could be that they are putting various pollutants in mixed in with the fuel or the air or the exhaust or something. I don't know, but it's something mm-hmm. that I don't think is benign. I don't think.
Is that similar to cloud busting as we know it from Willem Reis?
Well, that's kind of like some people think that's the antidote to chemtrails, is to use these cloud busters and orgone energy generating devices. But I think that potentially, if we look at the weather control technology, perhaps that is based on some of the right technology, and maybe some of the field effect technology, which was used on 9/11, is based on some of the Tesla and technology and the stuff that John Hutchison's done. So it might be a combination of the two that are in use. I'm certainly feeling very much now that the weather is being manipulated quite heavily. Whether it's linked to chemtrailing, I'm not sure. There is something untoward going on in our skies, and I think you can pretty much see that quite clearly, whether you think of chemtrails or not. You know, with some of these weird cloud formations now, they had to have a cloud formation that they made up a new name for last year, the Spiritus cloud, because it's so weird. So there is something going on, and we do seem to be building up to something, with the move to the police state that everyone talks about, and, you know, RFID chips and the vaccinations and all this. It really does seem that somebody is trying to turn the screws to some final sort of conclusion here. So I'm not sure what that is. But going back to the chemtrails for a minute, what I'm trying to do at the moment, I mean, I'm doing sort of regular work to earn a living, so I have to fit everything else in around that, and perhaps like yourself, I've got young children to look after and this sort of thing from time to time. But what I'm doing at the moment is I've now got a unit. It's called an air nav radar box. It's an aviation enthusiast's toy, really. Although what it does is quite serious, and it allows you to track the aircraft that are coming within range of your house. It's got a range of about 130 miles, and you can actually track the aircraft, and it plots them on your computer for you. So I've been using this to make some measurements, for example, how many aircraft are coming over my house in an hour and this sort of thing. And it's quite clever because it can save, you know, it can log all the signals that it picks up into a file on your computer. And then I can now process this file with some software, which I've sort of done most of that. And I can come up with some numbers now. I think I'm getting some interesting figures out of it, because I've basically been able to get one day of heavy trailing, record all the numbers for that day, and then compare that with the next day where there's no trailing. I've got to go through the figures more carefully, but I'm getting a couple of interesting things coming out. I don't think it's going to prove anything really, you know, really sort of like major. But it might, and I think
it might help with the deeper research,
exactly.
You know, with the further
exactly.
Research.
Exactly. And already one thing I did pick out, and I've posted this already because it was the most significant thing that I've found. I had one day, it was the 5th of March this year, I had an EasyJet aircraft, which is a UK economy flight, you know, cheap flight company, and that. We had one EasyJet came over about 4:30 in the afternoon. Big long trail, you know, and I was shocked because I really didn't think that civilian aircraft were, you know, doing any type of trailing or anything. But I got a big long trail out of this EasyJet, and I photographed it. I picked it up on the scanner. I got the registration number of the aircraft. I videoed it, took a high resolution picture of it with my new camera that I've got, and then. An hour later, I got another EasyJet plane came over, same airline, same type of plane, which is an A311-111 or 319-111 aircraft, same type of aircraft, same height, same speed, one flight was going from, I think, from Luton to Edinburgh, which is an internal UK flight. The other flight was going from Stansted to Glasgow, I think. It's all the details mm-hmm. are on the website. And the second flight was only leaving a short trail. So what's the difference? So I've definitely got one instance there where I've shown we've essentially got the same conditions within an hour. One was about, these planes were probably only, what, I don't know, let's say maybe 2 miles apart in the sky, something like that. I might even be able to measure that distance if I'm careful. I could probably measure that because I've got the latitude and longitude that were plotted. So I wrote to EasyJet and I sent them this. I wrote this all down, put out all the figures in a little table. I said, right, EasyJet, I've got two flights came over my house. This one's leaving the trail, this one isn't. Please, can you give me an explanation? You know, I was hoping they'd write back to me and say something like, well, you know, for this type of flight, we use this fuel. And for this type of flight, we use that fuel. And it was this doing this or that doing that. And now I just hope they would give me some kind of explanation, you know, because if there's an honest explanation, fantastic, great, you know, let's get the honest explanation, let's get the answer, and let's move on. No, didn't even respond to the letter. So I waited for a month. You know, I've got other things going on. As you know, I'm always updating the website, this, that, and the rest of it, doing my work. So I'd kind of not got around to bringing the thing up again. But eventually I thought, oh, they haven't responded to my letter. So I emailed them. I went onto the website, clicked on the customer thing, you know, and sent them a letter, said, here's the details, here's the file. I think I sent them an attached file, sent them the details again by email. The next day, by email, they responded and said, we cannot answer your operational query. Here's a phone number. And that was it. That's all they said. We cannot answer your operational query. So, oh, great, you know. So they're not going to give me an answer. So, you see, I think perhaps why they haven't given, they may even have an answer, I don't know, but you know, an answer that there's nothing to do with chemtrail. There may be a logical explanation. I'm still waiting to find out what it is. There may be one. But the problem is, you see, that because I'm asking questions like that, they probably think I'm a terrorist, you see. Yeah. So that will be their cut. Even though they didn't say that in the letter, I would imagine that if they were pushed, that would be the reason that they would give as to why they couldn't give me any details, because I might be a terrorist.
Well, for the moment, that's the reason they give to everybody, yeah. You know, yeah. Asking for yes. anything, yeah. You know.
That's it. So this is the world that we live in, and I think it brings us back to a more general problem in that all the authorities, and I'd probably say that without exception, every authority that has any responsibility for anything has too much of a level of either of fear or corruption or self-interest to be sufficiently honest to be a valid authority. You know, I mean, we can extend that to all the cancer charities, for example. I don't give money to cancer charities anymore now because I know that they won't do research into diet and B17 and ESIAC and all these other things. They want to sweep those under the carpet because we know that they work. You see, and all the cancer charities, once we have a cure, and the cures have been around for 70 years and more for cancer, then they have their function becomes redundant. They don't need to exist. So they have a self-interest, even though they're supposed to have a benign purpose. They go hand in hand with the pharmaceutical companies who sell all the products for chemotherapy and you know, pain relief and all these other things. So so it's the same mindset across the board, really, as far as I've seen things. You've got self-interest, you've got fear, you know, behind everything, fear of they're going to lose their jobs, fear that their purpose is going to become redundant, you know, and this sort of thing. And that also is behind the chemtrailing. I mean, I wrote to the Department of Transport and they can't answer my questions. I had to get this box, you know, to do the aircraft tracking, because when I said to them what aircraft went over my house on this date and this time and gave them the latitude and longitude of my house, they said, we can't tell you. We don't have that information. So as an aircraft authority, they don't have the information to tell me what flew over my house, you know. So, you know, what's the point? You know, what are they doing? So you've got in other words, you have to be your own authority. I think is ultimately what the lesson is in all of this, you know.
And you have to educate yourself and ask questions.
Yes. That's right. I'm still doing this, as I say, doing this research with the air traffic monitoring, and I'm mm-hmm. in the next stage that I'm trying to do is I'm going to now, you know how you can do webcams, you know, and you see these webcams and they take pictures every so often, and then you can do like a time-lapse film.
And
I've mm-hmm. already done some of that a few years ago, because I've got some film time-lapse films made in 2005 on a little computer that I've got. But I'm now going to extend that because I've got two cameras which I'm going to point in opposite directions in my house out of the window. So I'm going to try and marry that up with the AirNav box to get the actual visual, you know, image of the planes coming over along with the aircraft tracking as well. So I'm hoping that, you know, when we get the next day, I'm going to have that rigged up so that I can get all that data logged and use it. But, you know, it just takes such a long time, you know, and you've got to spend money on this amount of, you know, this sort of equipment obviously doesn't come. Some of it's a lot cheaper than it used to be honest, but it's still not free, you know, so mm-hmm. you are investing both time and money in doing this. So I hope that we can get some answers, you know, that are going to be a bit more challenging for people to actually rebut, you know.
Yeah, great one. Well, excellent. Thank you for sharing all this information, you know. Before we're coming to an end, let's mention your website again. You offer there a lot of information as well as audio and videos. Tell us how people can come in contact with you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's checktheevidence.com, and there are various buttons at the top there, you know, five or six. There's an audio collection which you can log on. It's not particularly well organized. There's just lots of MP3 files that you can download, you know, probably several hundred hours, I think, by now. And then if you sign up and register, you'll be given an extra link to another audio archive, which has more stuff in there that you can go and look at. There's an audio section. There are a few downloadable videos. There's a video page, and you can download those if you want. A few of those have been deleted off other sites, so I decided to archive them on mine so that they were still available, you know. And there's various articles. There's a book that I wrote about 9/11, which is, I call it a book, but it's actually really, to be honest, it's a compilation of articles which were written over a three-year period. You'll see the banner for that on the website. It's called 9/11 mm-hmm. Finding the Truth. And you can download that as a, you know, simply as a PDF file. I also made it into an audio book, because I've got some software which will do the voice readout and stuff like that, and it will make it into an MP3. So I thought I'd do that. And that you can download that, all of that for free. You know, everything's free on there. If you want a paper copy of the book, then that costs me, you know, so many pounds to get that printed, or you can just go onto the print-on-demand website and order yourself one if you prefer a hard copy, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't get any money from that. It's just all that's...
Yeah,
you know,
it's a non-profit project.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you know, because mm-hmm. my philosophy is...
Very nice.
Yeah, I mean, my philosophy is I've got... You know, I've got the sufficient funds within my own time and work to fund it. So I fund it myself, because then that means at least I can't be criticised that I'm being, you know, taking money from all of this. You know, that's not mine.
And you're free and independent
yeah.
to do what you want.
Absolutely,
to do.
Absolutely. You know, I just want to follow the leads that I think are significant. And if people want to follow me, fantastic. You know, if they don't, fair enough. You know, if they've got other interests, then that's absolutely as it should be, you know. So that's kind of the philosophy behind it, and I've just tried to use my brain to as a filtering, really, you know. And I mean, I've had some quite appreciative messages, so that makes it all worthwhile, you know. You get some nasty messages as well, as I'm sure you've experienced yourself in certain ways when you put this stuff out there. You do get people who just say you're stupid, or you're just doing it to make money or something like that. But then again, the majority of messages have been very, you know, expressing gratitude and very thankful, and so that's what keeps you going, really, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
And if it's only one person waking up, you know, that makes a sense already.
Yeah, that's a philosophy, because I don't feel I can challenge the major information sources, but you know, the joy of the internet is that you can get something like Joomla, which is a content management system, and you can get a pretty good website for next to nothing, for very minimal amount of money. So you can, in a sense, challenge some of these more powerful websites, and to somebody passing, you may look just the same as they do. So that's one of the strengths that we have now.
Yeah.
You know, that we've never had a time like this as a way of, we've never had this ability to discover and share information as we are doing now. You know, free high quality voice conferencing, we've never had that up until the last sort of 3-4 years, and it's just getting better and better, video, and so with all the bad things that are going on in the world, we've got the greatest opportunity now to fix those, if only we can keep positive and work out, you know, who's trying to keep us away from the good stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's sort of, you know, my philosophy, really. You know, let's get to the good stuff.
Yeah, I can only admit to that. Yeah. Well, Andrew, thank you very much for being my guest and sharing your knowledge with us. So if you want, we can do this even again, maybe on some of your other works, you know.
Sure.
Or to update people about Check the Evidence.
Absolutely, yeah? Yes. And thank you very much for inviting me to do the program with you. Yeah, it's been great.
Okay. Thanks,
thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the program. For more information and free downloads, go to our website on nightfall-project.com. There you can also find Nightfall's music and videos.